is that there should be geese and frigate birds with webbed feet living on the dry land and rarely alighting on the water, that there should be long-toed corncrakes living in meadows instead of in swamps, that there should be woodpeckers where hardly a tree grows, that there should be diving thrushes and diving hymenoptera, and petrels with the habits of auks. Organs of extreme perfection and complication. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. When it was first said that the sun stood still and the world turned round, the common sense of mankind declared the doctrine false. But the old saying of vox populi vox Dei, as every philosopher knows, cannot be trusted in science. Reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a simple and imperfect eye to one complex and perfect can be shown to exist, each grade being useful to its possessor, as is certainly the case, if further the eye ever varies, and the variations be inherited, as is likewise certainly the case, and if such variations should be useful to any animal under changing conditions of life, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could be formed by natural selection, though insuperable by our imagination, should not be considered as subversive of the theory. Our nerve comes to be sensitive to light hardly concerns us more than how life itself originated. But I may remark that as some of the lowest organisms in which nerves cannot be detected are capable of perceiving light, it does not seem impossible that certain sensitive elements in their sarcode should become aggregated and developed into nerves endowed with this special sensibility. In searching for the gradations through which an organ in any species has been perfected, we ought to look exclusively to its lineal progenitors. But this is scarcely ever possible, and we are forced to look to other species and genera of the same group, that is, to the collateral descendants from the same parent form, in order to see what gradations are possible, and for the chance of some gradations having been transmitted in an unaltered or little altered condition. But the state of the same organ in distinct classes may incidentally throw light on the steps by which it has been perfected. The simplest organ, which can be called an eye, consists of an optic nerve, surrounded by pigment cells and covered by translucent skin, but without any lens or other refractive body. We may, however, according to Monsieur Jourdain, descend even a step lower and find aggregates of pigment cells apparently serving as organs of vision, without any nerves, and resting merely on sarcodic tissue. Eyes of the above simple nature are not capable of distinct vision, and serve only to distinguish light from darkness. In certain starfishes, small depressions in the layer of pigment which surrounds the nerve are filled, as described by the author just quoted, with transparent gelatinous matter projecting with a convex surface, like the cornea in the higher animals. He suggests that this serves not to form an image, but only to concentrate the luminous rays and render their perception more easy. In this concentration of the rays, we gain the first and by far the most important step towards the formation of a true picture-forming eye. For we have only to place the naked extremity of the optic nerve, which in some of the lower animals lies deeply buried in the body, and in some near the surface, at the right distance from the concentrating apparatus, and an image will be formed on it. In the great class of the articulata, we may start from an optic nerve simply coated with pigment, the latter sometimes forming a sort of pupil, but destitute of lens or other optical contrivance. With insects, it is now known that the numerous facets on the cornea of their great compound eyes form true lenses, and that the cones include curiously modified nervous filaments. But these organs in the articulata are so much diversified that Müller formerly made three main classes with seven subdivisions, besides a fourth main class of aggregated simple eyes. When we reflect on these facts, here given much too briefly, with respect to the wide, diversified and graduated range of structure in the eyes of the lower animals, And when we bear in mind how small the number of all living forms must be in comparison with those which have become extinct, the difficulty ceases to be very great in believing that natural selection may have converted the simple apparatus of an optic nerve, coated with pigment and invested by transparent membrane, into an optical instrument as perfect as is possessed by any member of the articulata class. He who will go thus far ought not to hesitate to go one step further if he finds on finishing this volume that large bodies of facts, otherwise inexplicable, can be explained by the theory of modification through natural selection. He ought to admit that a structure even as perfect as an eagle's eye might be thus formed, although in this case he does not know the transitional states. It has been objected that in order to modify the eye and still preserve it as a perfect instrument, many changes would have to be effected simultaneously, which, it is assumed, could not be done through natural selection. But as I have attempted to show in my work on the variation of domestic animals, it is not necessary to suppose that the modifications were all simultaneous if they were extremely slight and gradual. Different kinds of modification would also serve for the same general purpose. As Mr. Wallace has remarked, if a lens has too short or long a focus, it may be amended either by an alteration of curvature or an alteration of density. If the curvature be irregular and the rays do not converge to a point, then any increased regularity of curvature will be an improvement. So the contraction of the iris and the muscular movements of the eye are neither of them essential to vision, but only improvements which might have been added and perfected at any stage of the construction of the instrument. Within the highest division of the animal kingdom, namely the vertebrata, we can start from an eye so simple that it consists, as in the lancelet, of a little sac of transparent skin furnished with a nerve and lined with pigment, but destitute of any other apparatus. In fishes and reptiles, as Owen has remarked, the range of gradation of dioptric structures is very great. It is a significant fact that even in man, according to the high authority of Foucault, the beautiful crystalline lens is formed in the embryo by an accumulation of epidermic cells lying in a sac-like fold of the skin, and the vitreous body is formed from embryonic subcutaneous tissue. To arrive, however, at a just conclusion regarding the formation of the eye, with all its marvellous yet not absolutely perfect characters, it is indispensable that the reason should conquer the imagination. But I have felt the difficulty far too keenly to be surprised at others hesitating to extend the principle of natural selection to so startling a length. It is scarcely possible to avoid comparing the eye with the telescope. We know that this instrument has been perfected by the long-continued efforts of the highest human intellects, and we naturally infer that the eye has been formed by a somewhat analogous process. But may not this inference be presumptuous? Have we any right to assume that the Creator works by intellectual powers like those of a man? If we must compare the eye to an optical instrument, we ought in imagination to take a thick layer of transparent tissue, with spaces filled with fluid, and with a nerve sensitive to light beneath, and then suppose every part of this layer to be continually changing slowly in density, so as to separate into layers of different densities and thicknesses, placed at different distances from each other, and with the surfaces of each layer slowly changing in form. Further, we must suppose that there is a power, represented by natural selection or the survival of the fittest, always intently watching each slight alteration in the transparent layers, and carefully preserving each which, under varied circumstances, in any way or degree tends to produce a distincter image. We must suppose each new state of the instrument to be multiplied by the million, each to be preserved until a better is produced, and then the old ones to be all destroyed. In living bodies, variation will cause the slight alteration, generation will multiply them almost infinitely, and natural selection will pick out with unerring skill each improvement. Let this process go on for millions of years, and during each year on millions of individuals of many kinds. And may we not believe that a living optical instrument might thus be formed as superior to one of glass, as the works of the Creator are to those of man. Modes of transition. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. No doubt many organs exist of which we do not know the transitional grades, more especially if we look to much isolated species around which, according to the theory, there has been much extinction. Or again, if we take an organ common to all the members of a class, for in this latter case the organ must have been originally formed at a remote period, since which all the many members of the class have been developed, and in order to discover the early transitional grades through which the organ has passed, we should have to look to very ancient ancestral forms long since become extinct. We should be extremely cautious in concluding that an organ could not have been formed by transitional gradations of some kind. Numerous cases could be given among the lower animals of the same organ performing at the same time wholly distinct functions. Thus, in the larva of the dragonfly and in the fish Cobites, the alimentary canal respires, digests, and excretes. In the hydra, the animal may be turned inside out and the exterior surface will then digest and the stomach respire. In such cases, natural selection might specialize, if any advantage were thus gained, the whole or part of an organ which had previously performed two functions for one function alone, and thus, by insensible steps, greatly change its nature. Many plants are known which regularly produce at the same time differently constructed flowers. And if such plants were to produce one kind alone, a great change would be effected with comparative suddenness in the character of the species. It is, however, probable that the two sorts of flowers borne by the same plant were originally differentiated by finely graduated steps, which may still be followed in some few cases. Again, two distinct organs, all the same organ under two very different forms, may simultaneously perform in the same individual the same function, and this is an extremely important means of transition. To give one instance, there are fish with gills or branchiae that breathe the air dissolved in the water at the same time that they breathe free air in their swim bladders, this latter organ being divided by highly vascular partitions and having a ductus pneumaticus for the supply of air. To give another instance from the vegetable kingdom, plants climb by three distinct means, by spirally twining, by clasping a support with their sensitive tendrils, and by the emission of aerial rootlets. These three means are usually found in distinct groups, but some few species exhibit two of the means, or even all three, combined in the same individual. In all such cases, one of the two organs might readily be modified and perfected so as to perform all the work, being aided during the progress of modification by the other organ. And then this other organ might be modified for some other and quite distinct purpose, or be wholly obliterated. The illustration of the swim bladder in fishes is a good one, because it shows us clearly the highly important fact that an organ originally constructed for one purpose, namely flotation, may be converted into one for a widely different purpose, namely respiration. The swim bladder has also been worked in as an accessory to the auditory organs of certain fishes. All physiologists admit that the swim bladder is homologous, or ideally similar, in position and structure with the lungs of the higher vertebrate animals. Hence, there is no reason to doubt that the swim bladder has actually been converted into lungs, or an organ used exclusively for respiration. According to this view, it may be inferred that all vertebrate animals with true lungs are descended by ordinary generation from an ancient and unknown prototype which was furnished with a floating apparatus, or swim bladder. We can thus, as I infer from Professor Owen's interesting description of these parts, understand the strange fact that every particle of food and drink which we swallow has to pass over the orifice of the trachea, with some risk of falling into the lungs, notwithstanding the beautiful contrivance by which the glottis is closed. In the higher vertebrata, the branchiae have wholly disappeared. But in the embryo, the slits on the sides of the neck and the loop-like course of the arteries still mark their former position. But it is conceivable that the now utterly lost branchii might have been gradually worked in by natural selection for some distinct purpose. For instance, Landois has shown that the wings of insects are developed from the trachea. It is therefore highly probable that in this great class, organs which once served for respiration have been actually converted into organs for flight. In considering transitions of organs, it is so important to bear in mind the probability of conversion from one function to another that I will give another instance. Pedunculated cirripedes have two minute folds of skin, called by me the ovigerous frena, which serve, through the means of a sticky secretion, to retain the eggs until they are hatched within the sac. These cirripedes have no branchii, the whole surface of the body and of the sac, together with the small frena, serving for respiration. The balanidae, or sessile cirripedes, on the other hand, have no ovigerous frena, the eggs lying loose at the bottom of the sac, within the well-enclosed shell. But they have, in the same relative position with the frena, large, much-folded membranes which freely communicate with the circulatory lacunae of the sac and body, and which have been considered by all naturalists to act as branchii. Now I think no one will dispute that the ovigerous frena in the one family are strictly homologous with the branchii of the other family. Indeed, they graduate into each other. Therefore, it need not be doubted that the two little folds of skin which originally served as ovigerous frena, but which, likewise, very slightly aided in the act of respiration, have been gradually converted by natural selection into branchii, simply through an increase in their size and the obliteration of their adhesive glands. If all pedunculated cirripedes had become extinct, and they have suffered far more extinction than have sessile cirripedes, who would ever have imagined that the branchii in this latter family had originally existed as organs for preventing the ova from being washed out of the sac? There is another possible mode of transition, namely through the acceleration or retardation of the period of reproduction. This has lately been insisted on by Professor Cope and others in the United States. It is now known that some animals are capable of reproduction at a very early age, before they have acquired their perfect characters. And if this power became thoroughly well developed in a species, it seems probable that the adult stage of development would sooner or later be lost. And in this case, especially if the larva differed much from the mature form, the character of the species would be greatly changed and degraded. Again, not a few animals, after arriving at maturity, go on changing in character during nearly their whole lives. With mammals, for instance, the form of the skull is often much altered with age, of which Dr. Murie has given some striking instances with seals. Everyone knows how the horns of stags become more and more branched, and the plumes of some birds become more finely developed as they grow older. Professor Cope states that the teeth of certain lizards change much in shape with advancing years. With crustaceans, not only many trivial but some important parts assume a new character, as recorded by Fritz Müller after maturity. In all such cases, and many could be given, if the age for reproduction were retarded, the character of the species, at least in its adult state, would be modified. Nor is it improbable that the previous and earlier stages of development would in some cases be hurried through and finally lost. Whether species have often or ever been modified through this comparatively sudden mode of transition, I can form no opinion. But if this has occurred, it is probable that the differences between the young and the mature, and between the mature and the old, were primordially acquired by graduated steps. Special difficulties of the theory of natural selection. Although we must be extremely cautious in concluding that any organ could not have been produced by successive small transitional gradations, yet undoubtedly serious cases of difficulty occur. One of the most serious is that of neuter insects, which are often differently constructed from either the males or fertile females. But this case will be treated of in the next chapter. The electric organs of fishes offer another case of special difficulty, for it is impossible to conceive by what steps these wondrous organs have been produced. But this is not surprising, for we do not even know of what use they are. In the gymnotus and torpedo, they no doubt serve as powerful means of defence, and perhaps for securing prey. Yet in the ray, as observed by Matteucci, an analogous organ in the tail manifests but little electricity, even when the animal is greatly irritated. So little that it can hardly be of any use for the above purposes. Moreover, in the ray, besides the organ just referred to, there is, as Dr. R. MacDonnell has shown, another organ near the head, not known to be electrical, but which appears to be the real homologue of the electric battery in the torpedo. It is generally admitted that there exists between these organs and ordinary muscle a close analogy in intimate structure, in the distribution of the nerves, and in the manner in which they are acted on by various reagents. It should also be especially observed that muscular contraction is accompanied by an electrical discharge. And, as Dr. Radcliffe insists, in the electrical apparatus of the torpedo during rest, there would seem to be a charge in every respect like that which is met within muscle and nerve during the rest. And the discharge of the torpedo, instead of being peculiar, may be only another form of the discharge which attends upon the action of muscle and motor nerve. Beyond this we cannot at present go in the way of explanation. But as we know so little about the uses of these organs, and as we know nothing about the habits and structure of the progenitors of the existing electric fishes, it would be extremely bold to maintain that no serviceable transitions are possible by which these organs might have been gradually developed. These organs appear at first to offer another and far more serious difficulty, for they occur in about a dozen kinds of fish, of which several are widely remote in their affinities. When the same organ is found in several members of the same class, especially if in members having very different habits of life, we may generally attribute its presence to inheritance from a common ancestor, and its absence in some of the members to loss through disuse or natural selection. So that if the electric organs had been inherited from some one ancient progenitor, we might have expected that all electric fishes would have been specially related to each other. But this is far from the case. Nor does geology at all lead to the belief that most fishes formerly possessed electric organs, which their modified descendants have now lost. But when we look at the subject more closely, we find in the several fishes provided with electric organs that these are situated in different parts of the body, that they differ in construction, as in the arrangement of the plates, and according to Pacini, in the process or means by which the electricity is excited, and lastly, in being supplied with nerves proceeding from different sources. And this is perhaps the most important of all the differences. Hence, in the several fishes furnished with electric organs, these cannot be considered as homologous, but only as analogous in function. Consequently, there is no reason to suppose that they have been inherited from a common progenitor. For had this been the case, they would have closely resembled each other in all respects. Thus, the difficulty of an organ, apparently the same, arising in several remotely allied species, disappears, leaving only the lesser, yet still great difficulty, namely by what graduated steps these organs have been developed in each separate group of fishes. The luminous organs, which occur in a few insects belonging to widely different families, and which are situated in different parts of the body, offer, under our present state of ignorance, a difficulty almost exactly parallel with that of the electric organs. Other similar cases could be given. For instance, in plants, the very curious contrivance of a mass of pollen grains borne on a footstalk with an adhesive gland is apparently the same in Orchis and Asclepius, genera almost as remote as is possible among flowering plants. But here again, the parts are not homologous. In all cases of beings far removed from each other in the scale of organization, which are furnished with similar and peculiar organs, it will be found that although the general appearance and function of the organs may be the same, yet fundamental differences between them can always be detected. For instance, the eyes of cephalopods or cuttlefish and of vertebrate animals appear wonderfully alike, and in such widely sundered groups, no part of this resemblance can be due to inheritance from a common progenitor. Mr. Mivart has advanced this case as one of special difficulty, but I am unable to see the force of his argument. An organ for vision must be formed of transparent tissue, and must include some sort of lens for throwing an image at the back of a darkened chamber. Beyond this superficial resemblance, there is hardly any real similarity between the eyes of cuttlefish and vertebrates, as may be seen by consulting Henson's admirable memoir on these organs in the cephalopoda. It is impossible for me here to enter on details, but I may specify a few of the points of difference. The crystalline lens in the higher cuttlefish consists of two parts placed one behind the other, like two lenses, both having a very different structure and disposition to what occurs in the vertebrata. The retina is wholly different, with an actual inversion of the elemental parts, and with a large nervous ganglion included within the membranes of the eye. The relations of the muscles are as different as it is possible to conceive, and so in other points. Hence it is not a little difficult to decide how far even the same terms ought to be employed in describing the eyes of the cephalopoda and vertebrata. It is, of course, open to anyone to deny that the eye in either case could have been developed through the natural selection of successive slight variations. But if this be admitted in the one case, it is clearly possible in the other. And fundamental differences of structure in the visual organs of two groups might have been anticipated in accordance with this view of their manner of formation. As two men have sometimes independently hit on the same invention, so in the several foregoing cases it appears that natural selection, working for the good of each being and taking advantage of all favourable variations, has produced similar organs, as far as function is concerned, in distinct organic beings which owe none of their structure in common to inheritance from a common progenitor. Fritz Müller, in order to test the conclusions arrived at in this volume, has followed out with much care a nearly similar line of argument. Several families of crustaceans include a few species possessing an air-breathing apparatus and fitted to live out of the water. In two of these families, which were more especially examined by Müller, and which are nearly related to each other, the species agree most closely in all important characters, namely in their sense organs, circulating systems, in the position of the tufts of hair within their complex stomachs, and lastly in the whole structure of the water-breathing branchiae, even to the microscopical hooks by which they are cleansed. Hence it might have been expected that in the few species belonging to both families which live on the land, the equally important air-breathing apparatus would have been the same. For why should this one apparatus, given for the same purpose, have been made to differ, while all the other important organs were closely similar, or rather, identical? Fritz Müller argues that this close similarity in so many points of structure must, in accordance with the views advanced by me, be accounted for by inheritance from a common progenitor. But as the vast majority of the species in the above two families, as well as most other crustaceans, are aquatic in their habits, it is improbable in the highest degree that their common progenitor should have been adapted for breathing air. Müller was thus led carefully to examine the apparatus in the air-breathing species, and he found it to differ in each in several important points, as in the position of the orifices, in the manner in which they are opened and closed, and in some accessory details. Now, such differences are intelligible, and might even have been expected on the supposition that species belonging to distinct families had slowly become adapted to live more and more out of water and to breathe the air. For these species, from belonging to distinct families, would have differed to a certain extent, and in accordance with the principle that the nature of each variation depends on two factors, viz. The nature of the organism and that of the surrounding conditions, their variability assuredly would not have been exactly the same. Consequently, natural selection would have had different materials or variations to work on in order to arrive at the same functional result, and the structures thus acquired would almost necessarily have differed. On the hypothesis of separate acts of creation, the whole case remains unintelligible. This line of argument seems to have had great weight in leading Fritz Müller to accept the views maintained by me in this volume. Another distinguished zoologist, the late Professor Claparède, has argued in the same manner and has arrived at the same result. He shows that there are parasitic mites, Acaridae, belonging to distinct subfamilies and families which are furnished with hair claspers. These organs must have been independently developed, as they could not have been inherited from a common progenitor. And in the several groups, they are formed by the modification of the forelegs, of the hind legs, of the maxillae or lips, and of appendages on the underside of the hind part of the body. In the foregoing cases, we see the same end gained and the same function performed in beings not at all or only remotely allied by organs in appearance, though not in development, closely similar. On the other hand, it is a common rule throughout nature that the same end should be gained, even sometimes in the case of closely related beings, by the most diversified means. How differently constructed is the feathered wing of a bird and the membrane-covered wing of a bat, and still more so the four wings of a butterfly, the two wings of a fly, and the two wings with the elytra of a beetle. Bivalve shells are made to open and shut, but on what a number of patterns is the hinge constructed, from the long row of neatly interlocking teeth in a nucleus to the simple ligament of a muscle. Seeds are disseminated by their minuteness, by their capsule being converted into a light balloon-like envelope, by being embedded in pulp or flesh, formed of the most diverse parts and rendered nutritious as well as conspicuously coloured, so as to attract and be devoured by birds, by having hooks and grapnels of many kinds, and serrated awns so as to adhere to the fur of quadrupeds, and by being furnished with wings and plumes, as different in shape as they are elegant in structure, so as to be wafted by every breeze. I will give one other instance. For this subject of the same end being gained by the most diversified means well deserves attention. Some authors maintain that organic beings have been formed in many ways for the sake of mere variety, almost like toys in a shop. But such a view of nature is incredible. With plants having separated sexes, and with those in which, though hermaphrodites, the pollen does not spontaneously fall on the stigma, some aid is necessary for their fertilization. With several kinds, this is effected by the pollen grains, which are light and incoherent, being blown by the wind through mere chance onto the stigma, and this is the simplest plan which can well be conceived. An almost equally simple, though very different plan, occurs in many plants in which a symmetrical flower secretes a few drops of nectar and is consequently visited by insects, and these carry the pollen from the anthers to the stigma. From this simple stage we may pass through an inexhaustible number of contrivances, all for the same purpose and effected in essentially the same manner, but entailing changes in every part of the flower. The nectar may be stored in variously shaped receptacles, with the stamens and pistils modified in many ways, sometimes forming trap-like contrivances, and sometimes capable of neatly adapted movements through irritability or elasticity. From such structures we may advance till we come to such a case of extraordinary adaptation as that lately described by Dr. Kruger in the Corianthes. This orchid has part of its labellum or lower lip hollowed out into a great bucket, into which drops of almost pure water continually fall from two secreting horns which stand above it. And when the bucket is half full, the water overflows by a spout on one side. The basal part of the labellum stands over the bucket, and is itself hollowed out into a sort of chamber with two lateral entrances. Within this chamber there are curious fleshy ridges. The most ingenious man, if he had not witnessed what takes place, could never have imagined what purpose all these parts serve. But Dr. Kruger saw crowds of large humblebees visiting the gigantic flowers of this orchid, not in order to suck nectar, but to gnaw off the ridges within the chamber above the bucket. In doing this, they frequently pushed each other into the bucket, and their wings being thus wetted, they could not fly away, but were compelled to crawl out through the passage formed by the spout or overflow. Dr. Kruger saw a continual procession of bees thus crawling out of their involuntary bath. The passage is narrow, and is roofed over by the column, so that a bee, in forcing its way out, first rubs its back against the viscid stigma, and then against the viscid glands of the pollen masses. The pollen masses are thus glued to the back of the bee which first happens to crawl out through the passage of a lately expanded flower, and are thus carried away. Dr. Kruger sent me a flower in spirits of wine, with a bee which he had killed before it had quite crawled out, with a pollen mass still fastened to its back. When the bee, thus provided, flies to another flower, or to the same flower a second time, and is pushed by its comrades into the bucket and then crawls out by the passage, the pollen mass necessarily comes first into contact with the viscid stigma and adheres to it, and the flower is fertilized. Now at last we see the full use of every part of the flower, of the water-secreting horns of the bucket half full of water, which prevents the bees from flying away and forces them to crawl out through the spout and rub against the properly placed viscid pollen masses and the viscid stigma. The construction of the flower in another closely allied orchid, namely the catasetum, is widely different, though serving the same end, and is equally curious. Bees visit these flowers, like those of the corianthes, in order to gnaw the labellum. In doing this, they inevitably touch a long, tapering, sensitive projection, or, as I have called it, the antenna. This antenna, when touched, transmits a sensation or vibration to a certain membrane, which is instantly ruptured. This sets free a spring by which the pollen mass is shot forth, like an arrow, in the right direction, and adheres by its viscid extremity to the back of the bee. The pollen mass of the male plant, for the sexes are separate in this orchid, is thus carried to the flower of the female plant, where it is brought into contact with the stigma, which is viscid enough to break certain elastic threads and retain the pollen, thus effecting fertilization. How, it may be asked, in the foregoing, and in innumerable other instances, can we understand the graduated scale of complexity and the multifarious means for gaining the same end? The answer, no doubt, is, as already remarked, that when two forms vary which already differ from each other in some slight degree, the variability will not be of the same exact nature, and consequently the results obtained through natural selection for the same general purpose will not be the same. We should also bear in mind that every highly developed organism has passed through many changes, and that each modified structure tends to be inherited, so that each modification will not readily be quite lost, but may be again and again further altered. Hence the structure of each part of each species, for whatever purpose it may serve, is the sum of many inherited changes through which the species has passed during its successive adaptations to changed habits and conditions of life. Finally, then, although in many cases it is most difficult even to conjecture by what transitions organs could have arrived at their present state, yet considering how small the proportion of living and known forms is to the extinct and unknown, I have been astonished how rarely an organ can be named towards which no transitional grade is known to lead. It is certainly true that new organs, appearing as if created for some special purpose, rarely or never appear in any being, as indeed is shown by that old but somewhat exaggerated canon in natural history of natura non facit saltum. We meet with this admission in the writings of almost every experienced naturalist. Or, as Milne Edwards has well expressed it, nature is prodigal in variety, but niggard in innovation. Why, on the theory of creation, should there be so much variety and so little real novelty? Why should all the parts and organs of many independent beings, each supposed to have been separately created for its own proper place in nature, be so commonly linked together by graduated steps? Why should not nature take a sudden leap from structure to structure? On the theory of natural selection, we can clearly understand why she should not, for natural selection acts only by taking advantage of slight successive variations. She can never take a great and sudden leap, but must advance by the short and sure, though slow, steps. Organs of little apparent importance as affected by natural selection. As natural selection acts by life and death, by the survival of the fittest, and by the destruction of the less well-fitted individuals, I have sometimes felt great difficulty in understanding the origin or formation of parts of little importance. Almost as great, though of a very different kind, as in the case of the most perfect and complex organs. In the first place, we are much too ignorant in regard to the whole economy of any one organic being to say what slight modifications would be of importance or not. In a former chapter, I have given instances of very trifling characters, such as the down on fruit and the colour of its flesh, the colour of the skin and hair of quadrupeds, which, from being correlated with constitutional differences, or from determining the attacks of insects, might assuredly be acted on by natural selection. The tail of the giraffe looks like an artificially constructed fly-flapper, and it seems at first incredible that this could have been adapted for its present purpose by successive slight modifications, each better and better fitted for so trifling an object as to drive away flies. Yet we should pause before being too positive even in this case, for we know that the distribution and existence of cattle and other animals in South America absolutely depend on their power of resisting the attacks of insects, so that individuals which could by any means defend themselves from these small enemies would be able to range into new pastures and thus gain a great advantage. It is not that the larger quadrupeds are actually destroyed, except in some rare cases, by flies, but they are incessantly harassed and their strength reduced, so that they are more subject to disease, or not so well enabled in a coming dearth to search for food or to escape from beasts of prey. Organs now of trifling importance have probably in some cases been of high importance to an early progenitor and, after having been slowly perfected at a former period, have been transmitted to existing species in nearly the same state, although now of very slight use. But any actually injurious deviations in their structure would, of course, have been checked by natural selection. Seeing how important an organ of locomotion the tail is in most aquatic animals, its general presence and use for many purposes in so many land animals, which in their lungs or modified swim bladders betray their aquatic origin, may perhaps be thus accounted for. A well-developed tail having been formed in an aquatic animal, it might subsequently come to be worked in for all sorts of purposes, as a fly-flapper, an organ of prehension, or as an aid in turning, as in the case of the dog, though the aid in this latter respect must be slight, for the hare with hardly any tail can double still more quickly. In the second place, we may easily err in attributing importance to characters and in believing that they have been developed through natural selection. We must by no means overlook the effects of the definite action of changed conditions of life, of so-called spontaneous variations, which seem to depend in a quite subordinate degree on the nature of the conditions, of the tendency to reversion to long-lost characters, of the complex laws of growth, such as of correlation, comprehension, of the pressure of one part on another, etc., and finally, of sexual selection, by which characters of use to one sex are often gained and then transmitted more or less perfectly to the other sex, though of no use to the sex. But structures thus indirectly gained, although at first of no advantage to a species, may subsequently have been taken advantage of by its modified descendants under new conditions of life and newly acquired habits. If green woodpeckers alone had existed, and we did not know that there were many black and pied kinds, I dare say that we should have thought that the green colour was a beautiful adaptation to conceal this tree-frequenting bird from its enemies, and consequently that it was a character of importance and had been acquired through natural selection. As it is, the colour is probably in chief part due to sexual selection. A trailing palm in the Malay archipelago climbs the loftiest trees by the aid of exquisitely constructed hooks clustered around the ends of the branches, and this contrivance no doubt is of the highest service to the plant. But as we see nearly similar hooks on many trees which are not climbers and which, as there is reason to believe from the distribution of the thorn-bearing species in Africa and South America, serve as a defence against browsing quadrupeds, So the spikes on the palm may at first have been developed for this object, and subsequently have been improved and taken advantage of by the plant as it underwent further modification and became a climber. The naked skin on the head of a vulture is generally considered as a direct adaptation for wallowing in putridity. And so it may be. Or it may possibly be due to the direct action of putrid matter. But we should be very cautious in drawing any such inference when we see that the skin on the head of the clean-feeding male turkey is likewise naked. The sutures in the skulls of young mammals have been advanced as a beautiful adaptation for aiding parturition, and no doubt they facilitate, or may be indispensable for this act. But as sutures occur in the skulls of young birds and reptiles, which have only to escape from a broken egg, we may infer that this structure has arisen from the laws of growth and has been taken advantage of in the parturition of the higher animals. We are profoundly ignorant of the cause of each slight variation or individual difference, and we are immediately made conscious of this by reflecting on the differences between the breeds of our domesticated animals in different countries, more especially in the less civilized countries, where there has been but little methodical selection. Animals kept by savages in different countries often have to struggle for their own subsistence, and are exposed to a certain extent to natural selection, and individuals with slightly different constitutions would succeed best under different climates. With cattle, susceptibility to the attacks of flies is correlated with colour, as is the liability to be poisoned by certain plants, so that even colour would be thus subjected to the action of natural selection. Some observers are convinced that a damp climate affects the growth of the hair, and that with the hair the horns are correlated. Mountain breeds always differ from lowland breeds, and a mountainous country would probably affect the hind limbs from exercising them more, and possibly even the form of the pelvis. And then, by the law of homologous variation, the front limbs and the head would probably be affected. The shape also of the pelvis might affect by pressure the shape of certain parts of the young in the womb. The laborious breathing necessary in high regions tends, as we have good reason to believe, to increase the size of the chest, and again correlation would come into play. The effects of lessened exercise, together with abundant food on the whole organization, is probably still more important, and this, as H. von Nathusius has lately shown in his excellent treatise, is apparently one chief cause of the great modification which the breeds of swine have undergone. But we are far too ignorant to speculate on the relative importance of the several known and unknown causes of variation. And I have made these remarks only to show that, if we are unable to account for the characteristic differences of our several domestic breeds, which nevertheless are generally admitted to have arisen through ordinary generation from one or a few parent stocks, we ought not to lay too much stress on our ignorance of the precise cause of the slight analogous differences between true species. Utilitarian doctrine. How far true? Beauty. How acquired? The foregoing remarks lead me to say a few words on the protest lately made by some naturalists against the utilitarian doctrine that every detail of structure has been produced for the good of its possessor. They believe that many structures have been created for the sake of beauty, to delight man or the creator, but this latter point is beyond the scope of scientific discussion, or for the sake of mere variety, a view already discussed. Such doctrines, if true, would be absolutely fatal to my theory. I fully admit that many structures are now of no direct use to their possessors, and may never have been of any use to their progenitors. But this does not prove that they were formed solely for beauty or variety. No doubt the definite action of changed conditions and the various causes of modifications lately specified have all produced an effect, probably a great effect, independently of any advantage thus gained. But a still more important consideration is that the chief part of the organization of every living creature is due to inheritance. And consequently, though each being assuredly is well fitted for its place in nature, many structures have now no very close and direct relation to present habits of life. Thus we can hardly believe that the webbed feet of the upland goose, or of the frigate bird, are of special use to these birds. We cannot believe that the similar bones in the arm of the monkey, in the foreleg of the horse, in the wing of the bat, and in the flipper of the seal, are of special use to these animals. We may safely attribute these structures to inheritance. But webbed feet no doubt were as useful to the progenitor of the upland goose and of the frigate bird as they now are to the most aquatic of living birds. So we may believe that the progenitor of the seal did not possess a flipper, but a foot with five toes fitted for walking or grasping. And we may further venture to believe that the several bones in the limbs of the monkey, horse, and bat were originally developed, on the principle of utility, probably through the reduction of more numerous bones in the fin of some ancient fish-like progenitor of the whole class. It is scarcely possible to decide how much allowance ought to be made for such causes of change as the definite action of external conditions, so-called spontaneous variations, and the complex laws of growth. But with these important exceptions, we may conclude that the structure of every living creature either now is, or was formerly, of some direct or indirect use to its possessor. With respect to the belief that organic beings have been created beautiful for the delight of man, a belief which it has been pronounced is subversive of my whole theory, I may first remark that the sense of beauty obviously depends on the nature of the mind, irrespective of any real quality in the admired object, and that the idea of what is beautiful is not innate or unalterable. We see this, for instance, in the men of different races admiring an entirely different standard of beauty in their women. If beautiful objects had been created solely for man's gratification, it ought to be shown that before man appeared there was less beauty on the face of the earth than since he came on the stage. Were the beautiful volute and cone shells of the Eocene epoch and the gracefully sculptured ammonites of the secondary period created that man might ages afterwards admire them in his cabinet? Few objects are more beautiful than the minute siliceous cases of the diatomaceae. Were these created that they might be examined and admired under the higher powers of the microscope? The beauty in this latter case, and in many others, is apparently wholly due to symmetry of growth. Flowers rank among the most beautiful productions of nature, but they have been rendered conspicuous in contrast with the green leaves, and in consequence at the same time beautiful, so that they may be easily observed by insects. I have come to this conclusion from finding it an invariable rule that when a flower is fertilized by the wind, it never has a gaily colored corolla. Several plants habitually produce two kinds of flowers, one kind open and colored so as to attract insects, the other closed, not colored, destitute of nectar, and never visited by insects. Hence we may conclude that if insects had not been developed on the face of the earth, our plants would not have been decked with beautiful flowers, but would have produced only such poor flowers as we see on our fir, oak, nut and ash trees, on grasses, spinach, docks and nettles, which are all fertilized through the agency of the wind. A similar line of argument holds good with fruits. That a ripe strawberry or cherry is as pleasing to the eye as to the palate, that the gaily colored fruit of the spindlewood tree and the scarlet berries of the holly are beautiful objects, will be admitted by everyone. But this beauty serves merely as a guide to birds and beasts in order that the fruit may be devoured and the matured seeds disseminated. I infer that this is the case from having as yet found no exception to the rule that seeds are always thus disseminated when embedded within a fruit of any kind, that is, within a fleshy or pulpy envelope, if it be colored of any brilliant tint or rendered conspicuous by being white or black. On the other hand, I willingly admit that a great number of male animals, as all our most gorgeous birds, some fishes, reptiles, and mammals, and a host of magnificently colored butterflies, have been rendered beautiful for beauty's sake. But this has been effected through sexual selection, that is, by the more beautiful males having been continually preferred by the females, and not for the delight of man. So it is with the music of birds. We may infer from all this that a nearly similar taste for beautiful colors and for musical sounds runs through a large part of the animal kingdom. When the female is as beautifully coloured as the male, which is not rarely the case with birds and butterflies, the cause apparently lies in the colours acquired through sexual selection having been transmitted to both sexes, instead of to the males alone. How the sense of beauty in its simplest form, that is, the reception of a peculiar kind of pleasure from certain colours, forms and sounds, was first developed in the mind of man and of the lower animals, is a very obscure subject. The same sort of difficulty is presented if we inquire how it is that certain flavours and odours give pleasure and others displeasure. Habit in all these cases appears to have come to a certain extent into play, but there must be some fundamental cause in the constitution of the nervous system in each species. Natural selection cannot possibly produce any modification in a species exclusively for the good of another species. Though throughout nature, one species incessantly takes advantage of and profits by the structures of others. But natural selection can and does often produce structures for the direct injury of other animals, as we see in the fang of the adder and in the ovipositor of the ichneumon, by which its eggs are deposited in the living bodies of other insects. If it could be proved that any part of the structure of any one species had been formed for the exclusive good of another species, it would annihilate my theory, for such could not have been produced through natural selection. Although many statements may be found in works on natural history to this effect, I cannot find even one which seems to me of any weight. It is admitted that the rattlesnake has a poison fang for its own defence and for the destruction of its prey. But some authors suppose that at the same time it is furnished with a rattle for its own injury, namely, to warn its prey. I would almost as soon believe that the cat curls the end of its tail when preparing to spring in order to warn the doomed mouse. It is a much more probable view that the rattlesnake uses its rattle, the cobra expends its frill, and the puff adder swells while hissing so loudly and harshly, in order to alarm the many birds and beasts which are known to attack even the most venomous species. Snakes act on the same principle which makes the hen ruffle her feathers and expand her wings when a dog approaches her chickens. But I have not space here to enlarge on the many ways by which animals endeavour to frighten away their enemies. Natural selection will never produce in a being any structure more injurious than beneficial to that being, for natural selection acts solely by and for the good of each. No organ will be formed, as Paley has remarked, for the purpose of causing pain or for doing an injury to its possessor. If a fair balance be struck between the good and evil caused by each part, each will be found, on the whole, advantageous. After the lapse of time, under changing conditions of life, if any part comes to be injurious, it will be modified. Or if it be not so, the being will become extinct, as myriads have become extinct. Natural selection tends only to make each organic being as perfect as, or slightly more perfect than, the other inhabitants of the same country with which it comes into competition. And we see that this is the standard of perfection attained under nature. The endemic productions of New Zealand, for instance, are perfect one compared with another, but they are now rapidly yielding before the advancing legions of plants and animals introduced from Europe. Natural selection will not produce absolute perfection, nor do we always meet, as far as we can judge, with this high standard under nature. The correction for the aberration of light is said by Müller not to be perfect, even in that most perfect organ, the human eye. Helmholtz, whose judgment no one will dispute, after describing in the strongest terms the wonderful powers of the human eye, adds these remarkable words. "That which we have discovered in the way of inexactness and imperfection in the optical machine and in the image on the retina is as nothing in comparison with the incongruities which we have just come across in the domain of the sensations. One might say that nature has taken delight in accumulating contradictions in order to remove all foundation from the theory of a pre-existing harmony between the external and internal worlds." If our reason leads us to admire with enthusiasm a multitude of inimitable contrivances in nature, this same reason tells us, though we may easily err on both sides, that some other contrivances are less perfect. Can we consider the sting of the bee as perfect, which, when used against many kinds of enemies, cannot be withdrawn, owing to the backward serratures, and thus inevitably causes the death of the insect